The Cycling Podcast presents Life in the Peloton with Mitch Stocker. And I'm Mitch Stocker, so welcome. Guys, over the course of the next week, we're going to introduce you to the style of life in the Peloton. And what we're going to do is go back in the catalogue and show you some of the re-edited versions of some of the great episodes that I've done. Some of my favourites and some of the crowd favourites out there. Before our initial release of the first new podcast of 2020 on the 29th of January, just around the corner. First off the block, we've got Daryl Impey. And this is an amazing podcast. Daryl has a fantastic story of up and down road and career with some amazing highs, but some very big lows. And just to be able to see what he can do to be able to bounce back, it was truly inspiring for me. I sat down with him early last year in the cold depths of, I guess, Girona, which isn't that cold, but it was for me. And we nutted out a great little story over a cold beer. So I hope you guys can really enjoy this little mini-series and get your head around what life in the Peloton is really like and get ready for a big season of more episodes of Life in the Peloton. Enjoy. Welcome to Life in the Peloton. I'm Mitch Stocker. And today we've got Daryl Impey, South African, and we're going to talk about Daryl's up and down, his up and down career. And he's had many points in his career, I think, where the road could have gone left or right, and the road was much easier to go left. And he just went, you know what, I'm not done, I'm going to go back right. And some really, really tough moments, which I think has made him into the amazing rider he is today that we all see on the TV today. Welcome, Daryl Impey.
Thanks, Mitch. It's nice to be on the potty. It's been, seen so many other big names on you, so I'm doing something right to get a gig on the show.
Yeah,
so happy to be here.
You had numerous opportunities to go, that's it, you know, because like, let's go back to 2009, Tour of Turkey. Was it the last stage?
Last stage.
It was the last stage. You're in the yellow jersey, coming into the sprint, the final sprint, and Teo Boss, who used to be a pro with Rabobank, came from behind and physically grabbed your jersey and pulled you off. I went back and had a look at it, and I vaguely had a memory of it, and I thought, oh yeah, I think Imps got bumped off into the barriers. I went back and had a look at his footage. And you're just like, how has that ever got away? You know, and I think that was a real, in the beginning of your career, almost a turning point then and there. Just run us through that quickly. What happened there?
Well, it was just pretty much coming to the sprint. Final sprint, leader's jersey. I had 1 second lead on a guy called David Malakane. And, you know, it's from Quickstep. So I knew, you know, Quickstep, how they race for any kind of win. So I knew they were still going to try win the stage or try get some bonus seconds. So I had to be up there for the sprint. I didn't really want to take part in the sprint, but so I had to be up there. And it was just coming into the last 500 meters. Teo gave me a push to, well, I was on the barrier already. And Teo tried to squeeze through and try to push past me, and I was just holding my line, you know. And then next minute, I just felt his hand on my shoulder, and we were down in the barriers and came down. You know, he says he hit the little, what do you call it, little foot peg on the rail, and that's what. And he grabbed me. His reaction was to grab something, and he grabbed me and he pulled me down. And you know, it's still to the day I don't believe it. But you know, and we've had a few races where we've ridden against each other. I think the last time I actually saw him was Tour of Alberta, and he actually was pissing down in the rain there, and we're at the back of the peloton, and he was like, "Hey, man, wanted to get up for a chat there," and I'm like, oh, gave him like half a hey. And then he's like, we got discussing on something, and then he's like, yeah, everyone's always discussing, you know, this accident with me and you. And I was like, yeah, it wasn't just an accident, mate. This wasn't just like a quick little spill. And he was like, yeah, you know, but they make always such a big deal about things, you know, they keep on this, they still bring up this accident. Oh, it was pretty full on. Mm. You know, it doesn't really, you don't really see things like that often. And that was the moment there. I just brought him up, pulled him up straight up, and just said, right, wow, you and me, yeah, buddy. No one else says to know. You can tell me right now if you crashed me or not on purpose. Tell me now. And he was like, ah, oh, you didn't do it. Yeah. And I still can't accept that. It's a hard one to. It's
yeah,
a
but
hard,
I don't think you have to.
Like, no, it's like I just watched the footage and I think.
Yeah, just watch the footage.
The thing is, we had no bad blood before that. You know, we didn't have a bluey throughout the whole tour. It was the first time I actually raced tour, so we never actually run into each other. We had no issue during the race, so I couldn't work it out. I just know Rabobank was riding the last day of the sprint for him, that's all, and he was in a bad posse, and yeah, I was kind of the guy that took the brunt of it, but you know, it was quite funny because then you had like Robbie Hunter, who's a South African and a good friend of mine, and he was like after just grabbing Theo in the hotel room. And I always had a backup with Robbie in the beginning of my career. I always had a guy that stared up for me when no one else would, and it was funny because UCI and all those people just like downplayed the incident. They're just like, oh, relegated to the back of the bunch, you know, Impey wins, he'll be happy with the win. And I think it was also because I was small fry.
Yeah.
I think Theo was this big World Cup Kieran champion and he was this world champion. And I was just Daryl Impey just at the bottom there. You know, just like, oh, he won the tour. And like, it's, you know. And it was only when Lance Armstrong and Robbie McEwen and all these guys' Twitter just actually started then. And I think I got it like 10,000 followers just through that week of just long tweeting my name. And just saying how ridiculous it was, how the UCI hadn't dealt with it properly. And then I remember, like, you know, a few months later after being, I was in ICU for 2 weeks.
And that's why, just before you go on, that's why I want to talk to you. The main point I brought this up was that moment there, what was the situation from that crash that you had to deal with in order then for you to go, well, what was the repercussions of that crash?
So I'd broken my jaw. Yeah. And I fractured my L1 vertebra on my back. And
you're in Turkey too.
In Turkey. So I was in Turkey for a week in ICU there. And then I got transferred, did my first international transfer as a medical patient.
Back first to of South many.
Africa. Yeah, but this was like a repatriation thing. Yeah. It was like bring them back to South Africa, bring the guy back home. And I remember, man, they took 9 seats in the economy class. So they laid them flat. And then like they brought me up through the food truck. Through, so I came,
really?
I came in the thing that they used to bring the food up.
And why like wouldn't they just put you in first class? Wouldn't that be cheaper?
I don't know.
9 seats.
And then they flew 2 nurses with me too to like check up and check the vitals and all this stuff. Because I wasn't allowed to move. Like, so I just stayed on my back for I was on my back for 6 weeks. And I was in a back brace.
Do they put a curtain around?
Nah. It was just like next to just random guys. It was the weirdest experience ever. But going through the food truck was like, and then coming through the aisle, now they couldn't turn me to the side and I had to go straight, vertically. So I needed a person in front of me, a person behind me. And I was like, man, just don't drop me. I was just standing up straight, strapped in. I was like, man, if someone drops me, I'm just either going face planting or I'm falling on my back. There's
no, you were
way.
Just standing up.
Oh, I was on the board. Carrying on the board. Standing up. Yeah, on the board. They were just carrying me like that. And then they just like lay me down, they strap me in and were like, have a nice flight, you know? Well, that was it. And yeah, there you go. Like, so I was six weeks on my back. So then back in South Africa, I was obviously back another
6 weeks on your back.
On my back, yeah. The only time I could get out of bed was probably in the 5th week. When I could rock roll over. So before that, anything I had to do, just toilet, things like that. It was just like
6 weeks.
Yeah, it was pretty hectic. Patrick Alkani, he was like really concerned, you know. It was only South Africa that found out my jaw was broken. I kept complaining in Turkey saying I can't close my mouth. And they were saying, no, you lost a tooth. But because the jaw had split that much, they said I lost a tooth, but the jaw had actually split that much that it looked like I'd lost a tooth. Because when we got back to South Africa, the guy counts my teeth, he's like,
yeah,
your teeth are, yeah, your jaw is broken, definitely. So I had to get the jaw wired shut. And then it was like elastic bands and I had to get like liquid food for another 6 weeks. I remember I was like 60 kilos, you know, and now I'm like 71, 70. So like I got down to 60 kilos pretty quickly, lost all this muscle. And yeah, then the fight was on to get a contract again because, you know, I remember Hunter saying to me, listen, mate, it's great. You've got all these people and backing you and get well soon, Daryl, and you keep talking about your back.
But did you want to get a contract straight away?
I knew Bollywood was folding that year. We knew that. So yeah. I was like, knew it was just going to be...
But did that deter you, that crash?
I was still like, no, I'm going to get back. My focus was, I'm going to get back to Europe.
Yeah,
okay. I just went tour of Turkey. I was like, still like... Phew.
Even and after 6 weeks in the bed, it just drove it.
Yeah, I just wanted to get back.
Yeah, okay.
And am I...
When was Tour of Turkey?
2009, April.
April. April, okay, so it was early in the year.
So I got back to Europe probably at the end of July, I think. Yeah, I got back to Europe. I was racing. I did all the Italian one days.
At the end of the year?
Got my head kicked in for the first three or four. And then...
when's this? In September?
In October. September, yeah. You know, all those Emilia, Bugatti, yeah, and all those races. I was just getting my head kicked in there. But I...
Super lean.
I remember Hunter saying to me, stop telling people your back, something's wrong with your back, and you're trying to fix that, because that's going to be your thing that's going to be against you when you need a contract. And I was like, oh, take advice when it's given to you, take advice, say nothing about your back anymore, and just keep racing if you feel up to it. And I got,
even
you
know, though your back was...
Oh, my back wasn't 100%, but... No, my back was fine. I'd done the proper rehab and I looked after it. That's why I stayed 6 weeks in bed, so I could all mesh properly together and all of that. But I had to show the people that I could race again.
Yeah.
So it was about coming back, and that's when Johan Brunel gave me the contract to go with Radio Shack.
And that was 2010.
Yep.
So 2010, just 1 year with Radio Shack, yep, I saw. Was that just a 1 year contract and you thought they gave you a chance?
Yeah, I think they gave me a chance because I think they were hesitant with the back. Yes, I got a year contract there, and kind of, like I said, that was the time when I was like, you know, oh, okay, I've made it here. I thought, I'm in Radio Shack, I'm in Lawrence's team.
Mm.
You know, I flew to South Africa with Lawrence, like living the dream, you know, yeah, like, wow, rock star. And I kind of took it all for granted, I think. I kind of was just on this, like, I was doing my job, but you and I both know doing a job in cycling is not enough these days.
No, it's not.
You know, you do your job and you go the extra mile, that's what keeps you in the team. It still doesn't guarantee you a job, but it helps. So I think there I was just doing my job. And then at the end of the year, there were obviously guys from other teams that were doing a better job. And I struggled to find a contract. And that's when I signed with this amazing Australian team, which is Pegasus.
Another little hiccup along the way.
This was a really good hiccup. That was like, you know, December, I think Ellie had come over, you know, we had our training camp in Noosa, which was a bit weird. We hadn't built, like...
So wait, rewind a sec. So you got to the end of October... And Radio Shack said, we're not going to sign you? Or was it the vice versa? You found a contract with Pegasus and went, I'm going to go.
Well, it was strange because I was asking Dirk de Mol and Jan wouldn't pick up the phone. Brunel style, wouldn't pick up the phone. Dirk de Mol couldn't get a straight answer out of him.
He's the head director.
He was like the head director, couldn't get a straight answer. It was only Ekimov, who was also director there. And I said to Eki, I said, hey, man, I can take bad news. I don't need good news all the time. If I don't have a contract yet, just tell me now. And even he was like, well, have you spoken to Johan? I'm like, yeah, have you tried to get hold of Johan?
Yeah.
Not very easy to get hold of him. So, yeah, no, it's not looking good. And then I said, well, I have an opportunity to go to this Australian team. And then he said, well, if you have an opportunity, I suggest you take it.
Mm.
That was enough for me. I was like, okay, at least give me some kind of insight.
So you initially weren't that positive towards Pegasus, and you're just like, well, now that I know Radio Shack is probably not going to happen, I'm going to go with this Pegasus.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't because I believed, wow, Pegasus is going to be this amazing team. It was my actual only way out.
To give a bit of background for people who don't know about Pegasus, it was like, I think, and you can fill the gaps, is that it was starting out, it was going to be this new Australian team, a lot of funding behind it. It was the old Fly V Australia team merging into the first Australian World Tour team, and they grabbed all these good riders to come.
Yeah, they grabbed McEwen. I mean, there were a lot of us that were burned by it. Robbie Hunter was in it, Christian Knees. I'm trying to think of all the other guys that were there. Ben Day was there. There was a lot of guys. There was heaps of guys. Johnny Cantwell.
So what happened then?
So it was December. I remember sitting at the local surfing club there with Robbie McEwen. And, you know, I'd just done a training camp in Noosa. It was like a really weird training camp because no bikes were built, nothing. We had one mechanic there. It was like, guys, if you've got time to build your bikes, build them. It was like weird. It was the weirdest camp ever. We had a lot of fun. But I remember Swain Taft was also there. And I'm like, oh, man, this camp doesn't feel like a camp, like a team. Like, it doesn't feel right. You know, we like went through and I'm like, oh, maybe it's Australian way, you know, maybe it's a bit different. We'll check out it. Maybe it's all fun and games until we race and then it's serious. And Hendrik Redant was the director there and he was like, no, everything is all cool. And then we're having a beer with Robbie McEwen because I stayed on a few weeks after to train there with Robbie, and my wife came over to visit. And we were just having like dinner, and Robbie said, "Oh, got to have a quick word with you at the bar quickly." I'm like, "Oh, okay." Go to the bar there. It was like, "Oh, you might want to order another beer, mate." I'm like, "Well, standard. Yeah, all right." And ordered a beer, and he's like, "So I don't want to alarm you, but tonight you better make some phone calls to Europe." And I was like, "Well, what's up?" And it's like, apparently this team's folded. There's no money. There's no sponsors. Gillette, that was supposed to be sponsoring, is Chris White, that said he's got this magical team. Doesn't even have a team. He's got no guarantees in place. All of that. So you better phone Europe. And don't tell anyone, because the more guys you tell, the less chance you have of getting a contract. Yeah. I remember thinking, well, Robbie Hunter is not here, but he broke his ankle in South Africa. And I'm like, well, there's one guy who stood in my career that's always had my back. Now, I remember phoning Robbie and says, "Listen, man, I don't want to give you the bad news, but you're going to hear it probably tomorrow. Phone Europe, it's time, this has happened." And, you know, obviously he phoned around and he actually grabbed my spot at Radio Shack. So, that's not to say I would have got my spot back, but I was just like, geez, the irony. I was being the good guy then. I said, hey, it was actually McEwen and him that both got a spot in Radio Shack and I couldn't get back in. I was thinking, geez, the good guy. I was just like, hey, Rob. And I never ever held it against him, you know, like, because I would have done the same. You're in your mode of desperation. You got to find a job. You got to secure your job, you know, and we would have, any of us would have taken any job we could have got at that point. And so then I got forced to race back in South Africa.
NTN.
I couldn't get a ride in Europe, and I was back to racing the local 100k club rides races back in South Africa. Going from world tour, going from the year before flying with Lance in his jet to South Africa as like Daryl and Lance, and we're going here and doing all these fun things, and racing world tour races to coming back to my local club race and just being like waking up at 5, race starts at 6, because we're waking up sometimes at 4, and I was just like, but what am I doing? And then I've gone, and I've also said to my wife's, you know, dad just before that, like, you know, I want to marry a daughter. So this has all happened. And I've asked Ali to marry me. I've lost my job. I'm racing local races. And he's like, "You're going to be able," in a joke, he said, "Are you going to be able to look after her?"
Yeah.
And I was like, it is a joke, but it's probably not really a joke, because I would be asking the same question if I saw this.
Well, you
this professional person who's just lost his job is now, you can see that.
Yeah.
You can see the pattern coming. He's gone from hero to zero. Where's he going from here? And
were you shitting yourself? Were you like, how can I ever get back?
I was pretty like nervous, and I mean I had Andrew McQuaid, I think, was my manager at that point, and I remember just haggling him, saying, "Listen, man," and he's like, "Well, there's nothing available," and I just remember going, right, just take matters in my own hand, and I'm just going to email every single person under the sun that I freaking know in cycling that can help me. And then once I saw it wasn't really going to work out, I actually, with MTN, which Doug Ryder, he had like a small vision then, and he was quite keen to get MTN to the next level. And I thought, well, maybe this is an opportunity. And I started helping him and introduced him to cycling service, and we tried to get some races on the go.
What was MTN then? Was it Continental?
Continental.
Yeah.
So we were doing, so I did like Tour of Morocco, which is like a 10-day tour. Yeah. And like, I mean, you'd like, the race is actually the easy part. It's all the crap that's on the outside. Fighting for a seat on the bus. And like fighting for dinner. And that's the real race. Like, you go to dinner with a scrum cap on, nearly. It's ridiculous. Like, I mean, those African races are such a different world. So, you know, gone from world tour to that. And then, but it was funny because I was still trying to get back to Europe, and I thought, well, if I can't get into a European team, might as well try and push this MTN and Doug to see if we can get us overseas and at least do races where I can get seen. And to his credit, he actually did. We did sign a couple of races to do in Europe and that, but it was actually just shortly after I won a stage in Morocco that Stephen Kotzer, who was part of NetApp, and he was signed as a classics guy for them. And he said...
Oh, Koza, that's
and
right.
He actually messaged me and said, "Listen, we need some more help in this team. Would you be interested in coming?"
I didn't know he had so much pull there.
Well, he was seen as the big guy then. You know, he had done like a good Roubaix, I think, the year before.
Right.
Maybe top 10 or something, somewhere around there. And the team had obviously
valued invested in him.
Yeah, and he actually got me...
Did you know him at all?
Didn't really know him. I knew him from Girona, but didn't know him super well. And I got in contact with Ralph. And next minute, I spoke to Doug.
Ralph, who was it? Ralph Aldag?
No, Ralph... Ralph Dink.
Ralph Dink. Yeah.
So I spoke to Ralph, and anyway, deal's done. Okay, cool. I spoke to Doug Ryder from MTN. I said, listen, this has come up. He said, all right, mates, we can have you there. You can go there, but look, this month is for free on you. So I remember riding like May for free, doing Tour of Iran, leaving Tour of Iran, and going then to Ralph Dink. And thinking to myself, geez, well, that was my buy clause, you know? It was such a funny thing. But, I mean, so credit to them. I didn't have to, like, no one had to pay each other out and all that. And I got back with NetApp. And my first race was Bayern Rundfahrt, and then I did Tour of Switzerland.
Wow.
So it was awesome to be included in the Tour of Swiss, because that was the big race, you know? Yeah. It was a huge race.
Were you at the level after being out of the World Tour so long?
I think I'd worked pretty hard, and I was at a pretty decent level. I got in a couple of breakaways. I think I was in top 10 in one or two stages in Swiss, and then down the Tour of Austria just after that, and I was flying in Austria. Like, I was nearly top 10, I think, overall there. You know, climbing Grossglockner and all these climbs, I was really, really going well. And that's kind of when Greenedge surfaced. But I was still in contact with Whitey and that during all this whole Pegasus thing. And I knew there was a new Australian team. So I was always trying to have like a bit of a keep me in mind. And I remember it was always like, oh, we're thinking about you. We're trying. And then I messaged Shane Bannon and like, please, you know, beg. And eventually I remember chatting to Wilson in Lancaster because they were living here in Girona. And they were like, mate, looks good. I'm like, oh, what looks good? And they're like, and I reckon you might be in. You're the last guy that's probably going to come to this team.
Shit.
And it was.
Well, that was your first taste, or if you're already a listener, another revisit to Daryl's story. I hope you really enjoyed it. Once again, that's one I frequently go back and listen to myself. So just around the corner, coming up on the 29th, is our first episode with Jimmy Whelan. But before then, stay tuned for the next episodes coming up. Cheers. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.